This episode of Literary Treks is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform for creating a blog, website, portfolio, or an online store. Create your own space today by visiting squarespace.com and use offer code TREK9 to save 10%. Plus, if you'd like to support our programming personally, visit trek.fm/donate to get our new alien badges and art prints featuring original illustration by Tobu Ushi.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Taking all these books?
I thought I'd take some light reading in case I got bored.
Welcome everyone to another episode of Literary Treks, our dedicated Star Trek books and comics show. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me as he is every week is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. Matthew, we didn't record a show last week. We had something come up that unforeseen circumstances, so we had to take a week off, but we're back today, ready to talk Star Trek books and comics. How was your week?
Oh man, goodness, Chris, last week was busy. I like to think of it as concert week. I went and saw Mumford & Sons in concert.
Oh, that's right.
And,
yeah.
Then
Sanford & Son was on, huh?
Yeah, it was fantastic. And then on Saturday, went to another concert, and one of the big radio stations here put it on, and a bunch of people were there. So we had Plain White Tees, Johnny Resnick from the Goo Goo Dolls did an acoustic set. They had One Republic, Sarah Bareilles. So it was just a whole night of music. I honestly don't know how late I was out that night. It was that much fun. So,
wow, that sounds like fun. It's like we have those in the summer here in Tokyo area anyway. There's Fuji Rock Festival. They're Summer Sonic. Those two are quite old. And these days, we've got so many. I think there are like four or five of them now. And I started wondering, how are people going to all of these things? You know, there's a limited number of people, yeah. Limited amount of money they can spend on tickets. But there's another summer festival like that with, you know, 20, 30 bands playing over the course of 3 or 4 or 5 days. It's crazy, but a lot of fun.
It was definitely a great time. So,
was there any Klingon opera there?
You know, unfortunately, no Klingon operas. I was a little disappointed, but it's to be expected. Worf is busy, and he's not locked in the escape pod, you know, where the acoustics are just right for that opera. And so, no Klingon opera this time. Maybe next time. Maybe that, or maybe a little Klingon Shakespeare. So I get some real culture here because, you know.
Real authentic Shakespeare, right?
Exactly. You haven't heard it until you've heard it performed in the original Klingon. We all know this. And so you know, one can only hope. Dallas, everybody likes to think of us as uneducated. And obviously we are because we have never had a Klingon opera or a Klingon Shakespeare. So
when we live near Lake Tahoe, every summer they have a Shakespeare on the lake there. Right on the shores of Lake Tahoe. But they never did Klingon Shakespeare, so I was kind of disappointed in that.
That would be pretty cool to have that, I think, Chris. I'd love to see that done somewhere. Even just a small, you know, like maybe 10-minute rendition of something would be probably enough at that point.
that would be fun. So, all right, well, let's jump into our books news that we have for this week. And we've talked about on here a few times that they're moving towards doing more and more of these books that are ebook-only releases. And of course, that goes back to the Starfleet Corps of Engineers series, which was exclusively an ebook series. But now we're seeing more and more of that. And we have quite a few titles listed here in ebook news this week. What's the first one?
Well, we've talked about this one before, but Apps and Enemies with John Jackson Miller, going to be a Titan novel in the quote-unquote present-day 24th century. This one's due out in February, and you can already see listings of that on Amazon. We've talked about the next one, which is Seasons of Light and Darkness by Michael A. Martin. This one's supposed to be hopefully coming out in April about McCoy, during the events of Wrath of Khan, which is exciting to me, as everyone knows, I'm a huge Dr. McCoy fan.
I'm sure you're looking forward to this one.
Yeah, I really am. And then we have a third one, I think, Chris, you've talked about when I was absent, was Shadow of the Machine with Scott Harrison, set shortly after the motion picture, which is, for me, always a really interesting time period to be in. And this looks for maybe a release this December, but now it's vanished. So we're not really sure when this one's going to be placed.
Now, these next two sound really exciting to me, Matthew. Yes. You talk about original book titles. Apparently, Scott Pearson is writing a book, and Paula M. Block and Terry J. Erdman are also writing a book, and they're both calling their books TBA. I don't know how we're going to distinguish those.
Yeah, it's going to be difficult. Luckily, they have different authors. Hopefully, they'll have different ISBN numbers, so we'll be able to check.
And hopefully different cover art as well.
Yes. I mean, who knows? It's going to be tough, but so not a lot on the Scott Pearson book or the Paula M. Block and Terry Erdman are going to be writing a book as well, which is, hey, their first foray into Trek fiction, because of course they've done Trek into nonfiction. Fiction, fantastically as well. So these two books, there's no info on really yet what they're going to be about or when we should see them. But it does look as though maybe Pocket's going to do an every other month for these releases. So every other month you'd get a novel plus an ebook. I really enjoyed the Stuff of Dreams by James Swallow. And so I'm hoping that these books will be of that quality and really give us some in-depth look at you know, characters like, you know, Dr. McCoy or, you know, short set pieces like right after the motion picture. What was that like for all of those characters? I think this is a really great things to be able to plumb. So I'm excited to see what the you know, the last two, Scott and then Paula and Terry, will be writing about specifically, where they'll be writing. Because, you know, the nice thing about ebook is you can really put this anywhere. It doesn't have to be in all the continuity. You can just create a great short story about a character that you'd really like to kind of plumb the depths of.
Yeah, definitely. I think Seasons of Light and Darkness is going to be very interesting because it's going to be one of those stories where after you read it, then you can go back and you can watch The Wrath of Khan and you might get something new out of that movie just based on what we learned about Dr. McCoy from that novel. And that's always fun when you can go back and you can watch movies that are decades old and continue to get new things out of them. Kind of like we did when we watched between Space Seed and The Wrath of Khan. Some shows ago, we did the whole Khan Ruling in Hell comics. And, you know, those are fantastic because then you can have a little bit different take on the events of the Wrath of Khan based on what Khan and his people went through after they were left on Seti Alpha 5 at the end of Space Seed.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that, you know, the comics and the short stories, you know, really can do. And so I'm hoping to see that with these stories as well, especially too, even just the follow-up, you know, by John Jackson Miller here about the Titan. You know, they're going to have a big part of the Fall series. And so kind of seeing a short novella about them and what's going on with them, I think is a great idea. In the same way that after David Mack's latest series, Cold Equations, we saw the nice follow-up with James Swallow's book. And so I'm excited. I think this is good stuff. I love to see that Pocket is still really heavily investing in Star Trek novels and even now novellas to just put out ebook wise. And it's more for the authors to be able to do. And it's great for the fans, I think. I like that Pocket only does one book a month now, but I think having an ebook every other month or so is a great idea as well, because they're quick reads. You know, they're maybe $2 or $3.99, so it's not a lot on the pocketbook. It's really perfect for everyone.
Most definitely. Now, you mentioned that Titan is going to have a big part in the Fall series, and the other item we have here in books is about the cover of Peaceable Kingdoms, Dayton Ward's novel, that's part of the Fall series. We have the cover art, and, you know, you and I both have really praised most of the cover art in the Fall series. We were very unhappy with the cover art for Una's book, which of course has nothing to do with Una. It just has to do with the artwork that they chose for the cover. And that was a cover that had the Enterprise-E on it with that sort of crimson background. the book is called The Crimson Shadow, and so it's sort of, it almost looks like it's supposed to be a nebula behind the Enterprise E, but it's just not rendered very well, and so I don't know. It still looks like a temp cover to me, but apparently that is the real cover.
It is. I have it on my iPad, Chris, and that's the cover.
See, it's there. That's the cover. And that leads us to this one, Peaceable Kingdoms, which also has the Enterprise E on it, and which also has a similar nebula-type look in the background, except it's purple. Now, this cover is a big improvement over the Crimson Shadow cover, but still, it's nowhere near being in the league of the other covers from the series, and I don't quite understand what's going on here.
Well, and it is really strange to me, especially, I mean, all of the work that they put into creating the new Deep Space Nine, and they put that on the cover of David's book, and then it's on the cover of David Mack's book, and then it's, you know, you get the great render of the Titan from Tobias on James's book, and then these two books, not only is it just kind of I don't know, a haphazard cover that looks like just about anybody could put together on, mm-hmm. you know, Photoshop. I'm pretty sure you could, Chris, in about 20 minutes. But the render of the Enterprise E, I'm just disappointed with. I mean, Tobias has done some fantastic work with the Enterprise E itself. I wish we would have seen that at least there on the cover. I'm not sure why, you know, you would spend such time and effort on three of the book's covers, and then especially even the last book, you know, Dayton's wrapping up the series. You would think you'd want this cover to really capture, you know, the essence of this, the end of this series, and it just feels like a scene on the cutting room floor.
It does. The render of the E on Peaceable Kingdoms cover is much better than the one on the Crimson Shadow. The Crimson Shadow cover, again, it does look like someone had a clip art of the Enterprise E and they just stuck it on a red background with poor clipping paths. This one is better, but still, I don't know. Now, when we read the stories, maybe these backgrounds, the crimson background, the purple background here, maybe they'll make sense. Once you read the story and you'll say, okay, well, I know what scene this is depicting, but I don't know. I'm just disappointed. I feel like, again, as a designer, if I were doing a 5-book series, I would want all 5 of the covers to be of equal quality so that when you put them all together, they feel like they're part of a family. And it's this one story, The Fall. And I really think Puckett has dropped the ball here on the 2 covers that feature the Enterprise E.
Well, you know, I mean, the Enterprise E is a well-recognized ship, more so than obviously the new Deep Space Nine, which nobody had ever seen until that cover, and, you know, obviously the Titan is not as well-known either, so I just wish that it had gotten its due. You know, poor Picard apparently getting short shrift these days on the covers. You know, his face, nobody's face is even on the cover with him or something, you know, so I don't know, the other thing that went with this, Chris, was the blurb, and we're not going to read that as we have with some of the novels, and it has nothing to do with Dayton. It has to do with kind of protecting the book series. The first 2 books have only come out, and I really don't want to start giving things away. In fact, I really kind of glanced at this blurb. I didn't read it fully because I don't really want a lot of spoilers at this point for this series. And so if you want it, we will be posting this. This was on StarTrek.com. We'll have the link in the show notes here and in the enhanced podcast, so you can go check it out. But I don't want to ruin this for anyone that isn't quite ready for all this information. And so, but from what I read, it sounds intense. It sounds like it's going to be a great wrap up, and we all know Dayton. He does fantastic work, and so I have no doubt that this will be an excellent end to The Fall.
Yeah, I'm sure. I think, you know, primarily here we're talking about the artwork. As far as the stories go, I'm sure they're going to be spectacular. I know, Matthew, you're really enjoying David R. George III's book here to start off the series. I've started reading it as well, and I'm looking forward to getting the books. So we're definitely glad that those are out there. All right, let's move on. One more item here. This was a post that Dayton, he does this column on StarTrek.com called 10 for Word. Of course, Dayton Ward. I don't know, did you see this, Matthew? Dayton tweeted the other day, he got a tweet or a comment from a reader asking why StarTrek.com misspelled 10 forward. Because it's 10 for Word. And I think it was basically a virtual head slap in the tweet.
Facepalm.
It's
like,
it's a play on Dayton's name, people.
Yep.
And
yeah.
Guinan's bar on the Enterprise. Come on. But this post is a very interesting one. It's 10 Star Trek novels for the new Star Trek novel reader. So someone who's just getting into Star Trek books. Which books can you cherry pick from the hundreds and hundreds of books that are out there that would be a good entry point to introduce someone to the world of Star Trek literature? And I've read a lot of these, mostly the older ones, Matthew. I know you've read a lot of the newer ones here. What do you think about the selection that Dayton pulled together?
You know, Chris, as I was looking through the list, I feel like it is a very solid list. There weren't a lot of things that were missing from the list that I felt like, oh, goodness, I wish that they had put this on there. I think all of these
Avalon Rising wasn't on there, but that's probably because this wasn't comics for
exactly.
The new Star Trek comic
obviously,
reader. Okay.
Yeah, if we had been talking comics, there's no question that that would be on the list. Is at the top, honestly, at the list.
Number one, yeah.
There you go. Literary Trek's drinking game. I think we mentioned Avalon Rising at least three or four times, so you should be pretty smashed by now. You know, it starts out with Spock's World, and that is one of the most well-known Star Trek books. What I loved about this list, too, is Dayton had taken suggestions from people online, from bloggers and whatnot online, and he had taken suggestions from other authors as well. David Mack is in here with a recommendation, not his own book, but his friend Peter David. So I loved that this list wasn't just Dayton's compiling. He had apparently asked people, what do you think, you know, if you had to recommend a Star Trek book as a Star Trek reader, what would you recommend? And so this is what they came up with. Spock's World, one of the most popular.
Spock's World was suggested by Dan Gunther. And it's a novel that I feel like I read a long time ago. I don't remember too much about it other than, you know, it gives us a look into Vulcan culture, which is great because it's something that we feel we didn't really get through Star Trek until we got to Enterprise. So that was nice that Diane Duane filled in that. So that's a great pick.
Yeah. Then the next one, Chris, is actually one of my all-time favorites. And we have talked about this a little bit before, but Prime Directive by Judith and Garfield Rhys Stevens is hands down, I think, one of the best Star Trek books ever written. And mainly because of the reasons given here. They nail the characters completely, even while putting them in the kind of the worst situation possible. Giving a great representation of the idea of the Prime Directive itself and how far does it extend. Does the Prime Directive basically mandate the mass extinction and genocide because we don't step in? And so asking all these questions, really, really well done book. I can't recommend it enough. I mean, it's just, I think it's the book that I would give to just about anybody who wanted to read a Star Trek book. They've never really done it before. They're interested, you know, but they know the original series, say, read Prime Directive. You're going to love it. So,
yeah, I agree. This was suggested by Alan Gibson. And I haven't read this book in many, many years, but I do remember reading it and was just very enthralled by this novel. It's one of those books where you can't put it down. You just keep going and going and going. I remember reading it at work actually many years ago. It's like every moment I can get a break, you know, I'm out reading Prime Directive. It's great. And just everything that Judith and Garfield write, you know, this Federation, which is on this list too, just really, really good books.
Yeah. You know, now the next book, Chris, have you read this one? I have not. It's M'Zadi.
I have, again, a long time ago.
Okay. I think the reason I hadn't read it is because at that point I was not really into the whole Riker Troy thing. I didn't really care, you know. I guess I probably just wasn't old enough to really care about those characters in that way. It is probably something I should go back and read, because I have heard so many people talk about it and really, really like the book. What I really liked was just the fact that they talk about the idea that this is the point when they're really bound as authors, what they can and can't do, and that right. The story is still compelling even though he can't get them together. So to create that is good work. So I look forward to being able to read this sometime.
Yeah, and this book was so popular that there was a sequel to it, M'Zadi 2, as well, which was another book that Peter David wrote. And this is the book you were mentioning that David Mack recommended. And this one I used to have on cassette tape, the audiobook version. And so I listened to this one quite a bit as I was driving around town back in the day. This was released back in August of 1992. And the 90s were, of course, a time when we were fortunate enough to get a lot of great Star Trek books on audio. The next one on here is Federation, which I just mentioned a moment ago, which again is one of my very, very favorite Star Trek novels of all time. It was a story that brought together Picard and Kirk Generations, wasn't it? Because it was November 1994,
yes.
And so Generations was very soon after that. It talks about, it's another story of Zefran Cochran as well, you know, so bits and pieces of the character that we see in First Contact. And it's a book where I feel like in Star Trek First Contact, that certain elements or ideas in the novel may have influenced that film. Both this novel and another one that's not on this list, but we've talked about on here before, Strangers from the Sky. I feel like these two novels together influenced First Contact quite a bit.
Yeah, that I can see. I remember Federation. It was an excellent book. It was a lot different in the sense that you kind of expected Kirk and Picard to meet really in the book, and they don't really meet in the same way they do in the Generations. But I really enjoyed Federation a lot. I thought it was a fantastic novel.
You know, talking about remembering when you read books, and I mentioned I remember reading Prime Directive at work. Federation, when it came out, I had in hardcover, and I remember reading this book during orchestra rehearsals, because I used to play in a professional orchestra, but I play bass trombone. And so when you play bass trombone in an orchestra, you have a lot of time where you just sit, because you know, it's just the strings playing, just the woodwinds playing. And I read Federation pretty much the entire book during orchestra rehearsals. So a very memorable moment for me.
Yeah, that's really funny, Chris. It's good to know that if I want to play an instrument, but I want to be able to read a lot in the orchestra,
right?
Trombone is the one to play, because that's the one where I can pull out my Kindle or my iPhone and be reading and only have to worry about, like, you know, four bars every, you know, 15 minutes.
Oh, it's true. I used to play in the pit also for opera, ballet, and such. And we were doing an opera one time, and we're down in the pit, so we're under the stage. The only people that might be able to see us are people up in the third balcony. And we have this just extensive period of rest, and my friend Clarence sitting next to me playing trombone as well. And I look over, and Clarence is unwrapping a Snickers bar. I'm like, what are you doing, man? We're in the middle of a show. He's like, I'm hungry, man. I'm hungry. So that's what goes on.
That's really funny. That's awesome. Well, you know, Chris, I guess we should probably get back to this list. But the next
our
friends at To the Journey are going to love. To the Journey!
To the Journey!
That's right. To the Journey drinking game is in full effect right now. Mosaic by Jerry Taylor is next on the list. And, you know, they talk about this is a great book because it is the closest we ever got to an autobiography of Janeway. And I remember reading this book and really liking it, and the fact that they do kind of reference some of the plot points in this book later on in the series, especially Janeway's father and how he died, and all of those things. And so I thought this was an excellent idea. I wish they had done more of this. They obviously did Pathways as well. That's right. Take another drink, two to Journey fans. And so both of those really being her works and as close as canonical as you could probably get for the novels, since it was the creator of the show writing the book. Right, because it's written
by Jerry.
Right. Yeah. And so really well done. And, you know, as close as we ever got to, I think, maybe consistency in Janeway's character to having Jerry write a full, you know, this full autobiography of her. So,
well, this was a cool idea. And I remember reading Mosaic as well. And I remember where I was when I was reading this book also. But what was cool about Mosaic and Pathways is that, so Mosaic came out in October 1996, and it was written by Jerry Taylor, of course, who created the show. But it was being written early on in the run of Voyager, and it was a cool idea that the person who created the show is actually writing a supplemental material near the beginning of the show, as opposed to it, you know, coming afterwards or such. So it was a unique moment as far as the combination of Star Trek on screen and literature goes.
The other one that I like on here, that Ada Five, our good friend and blogger that I use so much for our news, recommended Articles of the Federation, and this really is a fantastic book. I mean, it's a completely different type of Star Trek book because it's almost all on politics, and it's all about President Bako and her first year in office, and it's fantastic. Getting that side of what interstellar politics is actually like in the Federation and being Federation president. And it helps you really see that, you know, Star Trek has so much more to offer than just kind of a space adventure story. There's a lot more to it. And I really feel like Keith DeCandido really took some of those ideas we see in Deep Space Nine of how you can do different types of science fiction inside Star Trek and really makes this book work. It honestly is one of the best Star Trek books I've ever read.
Remember when we had Keith on the show and we talked a little bit about this book and about it being very different and the process of getting it approved and writing it and, you know, being concerned like, are fans going to accept this or not, because it is a very different kind of book. But it's a, I'm glad they let him do it, and it's a great contribution to Star Trek. It's the kind of thing you need. I think it's what sets Star Trek apart from other franchises, is that it isn't always just the adventure. It really is sometimes, let's really delve in to the nuts and bolts of how the society actually operates at that point. It makes the Star Trek universe feel a lot more real.
The next book is, and we've talked to Dayton about this series, but Star Trek Harbinger. And David Mack, obviously kicking off the Vanguard series, a literary spinoff of the original series. So it was a big deal, something really different than they had done before. They had tried it with New Earth, wasn't quite as successful as they wanted it to be. But this series became a whole new thing. I mean, and it was a huge series for Pocket. And one of the, you know, I think the coolest parts was just it kind of, you know, from, I haven't read it all, but getting that kind of more lived-in feel that you get from Deep Space Nine, but putting that in the TOS era. I think
a lot like that.
Great idea, great first series. And so, yeah, what a great choice. You know, if you just want to introduce somebody to the novels, we'll give them a series that's just completely all about and exists in the novels. What a great idea.
Yeah, that's what Brian Cross, who suggested this book for the list, said, that for longtime Trek TV fans who haven't read any novels, there's lots of references to episodes and other plot lines. However, they're not so blatant that a newcomer to the franchise would be confused. So it is sort of, you don't have that baggage. You don't have to know. It's like someone trying to jump into Deep Space Nine in season six. You know, you're going to be completely lost as to what's going on in the story. And so here in the novels, this is a way, in literary form, to avoid that, a fresh take on Star Trek. The next one we have is the Crucible Trilogy by David R. George III that came out 2006 and 2007. And this was part of the 40th anniversary celebration of Star Trek. And they used the city on the edge of forever as a springboard to go into the story. I actually have not read the Crucible Trilogy. Have you read these?
I have. I really enjoyed the Crucible Trilogy. In fact, the Dr. McCoy book, which is the kickoff of the series, is just hands down one of my favorite Star Trek books, even if I hadn't read the other two. But really the way that David takes this series is that he uses the landmark episode and then uses the entire series and movies to weave in and out of Kirk, Spock, and McCoy's lives, these books, and does a really good job of it. And one of the greatest parts about this is that you can hand these novels to a fan who has only seen the show and the movies. They don't have to know anything else about the books, because that's all that David uses for the basis. So they kind of sit alone from the rest of the novels, which just makes them fantastic. And I think you'll be surprised, especially by the time you get to the end of the Kirk one, exactly what David does with this entire series. It is awesome. I really, really like this series. So I would highly recommend it. If you're just looking for something great to read, you need three great books, this is a fantastic place to start.
Excellent. We have another trilogy here by David Mack from 2008, the Destiny Trilogy. Now, I know that you've read this and have a lot of thoughts about this and, you know, what they do, I guess, with Ezri here as well, right? And is the Destiny Trilogy a good starting point for someone just jumping into the novels, or is there a lot of background that you still kind of need to know to get into that?
Well, the thing about the Destiny Trilogy is that it is a good place to start, Chris, if you have watched Nemesis and all the films, you know, up to Nemesis. You can really jump in at this point and, you know, kind of continue on the road then in the rest of the novels and where they've been. Because after Destiny, you can really jump into...
Destiny helps you jump into the Typhon Pact series and all the other stuff that comes out.
You're going to get into Titan. You're going to get into Typhon Pact. You're going to get into the Voyager relaunch by Kirsten Beyer. You're going to get into all those different places. And it does help you kind of move past, you know, from the Deep Space Nine relaunch, which is way far back, about 4 or 5 years in Star Trek time from this point. So it is a good place if you're just kind of wanting to start fresh and find a place that you can kind of kick off. It's not a bad place to be. Even though if you start with Destiny, you're still about 15, 20 books behind. But it is a fantastic series, though. I personally love it. I reread it last year again. I still love what David Mack does with the Borg and how he finally just brings them to an end, which needed to happen finally. Because I was tired of them as an enemy. And the way he does it, I think, is very, very, very smart. Very well done. And David's just a great writer in general. So yeah, this is a series worth reading.
I know this next one is another one that you're really high on, which is the Voyager relaunch. And this is Full Circle, Kirsten Beyer's book from April of 2009. This was suggested by Jeremy Woolward. And I believe you feel that Kirsten has really pushed the Voyager relaunch forward after it first got started. And Full Circle not being the first book in the relaunch series, how do you feel about it as the jumping in point?
Kirsten does a good enough job of giving you enough to kind of figure out what's happened to allow you to really jump in. And Full Circle is one of the larger Star Trek novels that we've had in a long time. In fact, if I remember correctly, when we talked to her, it was meant to be two, and they kind of wanted it combined all together so they could just get everything out there in mm-hmm. one book and then be able to move forward. And because there was a lot she needed to do to kind of catch everything up. And she writes so well, and she knows these Voyager characters so well, that you really do feel as if you are watching, you know, the continuation of Voyager. Everything that I would have hoped for. And yeah, she takes everything back to where it all started in the Delta Quadrant, but in a way that's really smart and makes a lot of sense. So hands down, a fantastic choice, especially, you know, if you've got somebody who's a Voyager fan, this is a great way to go.
Definitely. And if you're a new listener to Literary Treks or a recent listener, go all the way back to the beginning of this show, episode number 2 of Literary Treks. We actually have Kirsten on talking about this novel and writing Voyager. Really, really fascinating discussion that we had with her. So go check that out. Okay. And then let's just run through these real quick, Matthew. Dayton had some honorable mentions here that readers had suggested on his blog, The Fog of Ward. These include The First Adventure by Vonda N. McIntyre, Q-Squared by Peter David, Once Burned by Peter David, Avatar 1 and 2, which we've covered here on the show before, the DS9 relaunch books, and then Taking Wing by Michael A. Martin and Andy Mangels, which starts the Titan series. Anything stand out here?
Yeah, I think Taking Wing is a good choice. You know, you've got a great jump off series there. Titan is a really good series. I really enjoy Riker and his crew. I think it's really interesting. It's really well done. And it follows immediately after the events of Nemesis. So if you wanted to kind of see, you know, Riker and having his own ship, this is the place to go. And then, of course, Avatar 1 and 2, you know, without, yeah, so we've talked books. About this, Chris, without the Deep Space Nine relaunch, we wouldn't have, I think, anything that we've got now in the way that the books are done. And so fantastic choice there, but again, by 8 of 5.
Yeah, those are fantastic books. And as for the older books here, Q Squared is one that I always enjoyed, you know, back in the day. I also had it on audiobook format as well. So that's a fun one. And Peter David picks up on Trelane from the Squire of Gothos, ties that in with Q as well. So a very interesting thing there. If you like multiple timelines, you know, different realities in your stories, that's one I think you'll enjoy as well. So great list here. We'll put a link to this in the show notes if you want to go over to StarTrek.com and read Dayton's column and see everything that he had to say about the books as well. But good stuff for you if you haven't read them, or, you know, if you have friends who you're trying to get into Star Trek literature as well. Maybe they think, oh, the books, I'm not really into the books, you know, they're not canon. These could be some good suggestions that you can make to pull them in. Matthew, one more thing in news here. We have kind of a long news segment today. We do have a little bit of news on comics. This is the Early Voyages that's going to be coming out, Stardate Collection Volume 2, under the command of Christopher Pike, which is going to come out in February. What do you think about this?
I think this is great. I love seeing the fact that they are bringing all of these comics back, Chris, and just letting fans kind of get a hold of these in a way that they may never have before. There were a lot of comics back in the day that people just missed, like myself. So I love the opportunity to go back and check them out, especially, you know, something like this, seeing the early adventures of Christopher Pike. There's a couple of good novels that involve him too. So I'm always interested to see what, you know, his command style was like, what it was, his Enterprise was like, and all of those things. And so I'm excited about this. I think this is great that they are continuing to put out these Stardate collections and just working through the comics as they were produced. And so this is good stuff, I think.
Yeah, very good. So I haven't picked up the first one yet, but at some point I probably will. It's kind of one of those things where I'd like to pick it up in print, and it's really difficult to get my hands on that stuff here
right
in Tokyo. So maybe one of these days I will, but that's going to be coming out. So keep your eyes open for that. All right, Matthew. Well, that's all we have in news. But before we jump into our feature where we're going to talk about the new ongoing number 25 and just a little bit about ongoing today, let's tell everyone about our sponsor, Squarespace. Your support of Squarespace is very important to making it possible for us to bring Literary Treks to you every week. And it's a great way to support us because what you're going to get is an all-in-one platform for hosting and CMS, which is absolutely the best thing that you're going to find anywhere online. And you can use it to create your own blog, website, portfolio, and online store. You know, a website where you review Star Trek books and comics. Whatever you want to do, Squarespace is a great way for you to share your thoughts with the world. I've been using Squarespace for 6 years. Trek FM is built on Squarespace. I use it for my work. I use it for work that I do for clients. And apart from the simple fact that the tools are awesome, one reason I use Squarespace and a reason why I love them is that they are constantly improving the platform with new features and new designs and even better support. And they have the best support you're going to find anywhere, but it just gets better all the time. And what you do with Squarespace is you start out with a template. They have beautiful designs that allow you to just put your information out there with really no effort on your part whatsoever. But if you want to adjust those and tweak them, you can using various style options, and it makes it very easy for you to create a unique website for you or your business. And the best part about it is that it starts at just $8 a month, and you can even get a free domain name if you sign up for the annual plan. But you know, Matthew, we always talk about this. There are a lot of reasons to love Squarespace, but there are three primary things about Squarespace that make it so easy for you to get your web presence going. What are those?
Chris, I think one of the biggest is that it's design focused, as you were saying, and Squarespace really cares about the way that your blog or your website or your commerce features, the way they look. And all their templates are extremely clean. They allow your content or your store or your blog, any of these things, to be the focus, so that when people go to your site, they're not worried about trying to navigate. They're just seeing your content portrayed in just a beautiful fashion. And so that's one of the things that they do. The second is it's easy to connect all the accounts, all the places that you'd want to share your information, whether it's Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, Pinterest, Instagram, Google, and so many more sites that you can do that at. This is the place. It makes it simple and easy to be able to share your content like this to anyone you want to go to. And then, Chris, one of the things that's really nice is it's a responsive design. There's nothing more frustrating than going to a website that's not really designed for the mobile world. You know, so you have your phone and you're checking out a website, and it's just not able to move to the phone. And it just looks like it does on the computer. It just doesn't fit right.
And
everything's
small, and you can't
exactly
read it. Yeah.
You just can't see. And so everything scales perfectly with Squarespace. So whether you're on your computer, a mobile device, or a tablet, you're finding the right look for where you are. And that's one of the things that's just fantastic about Squarespace and making that happen. And it's not something you have to do extra. Squarespace does it for you.
Right, exactly. It's a very intelligent system too, but the way they reflow content, you know, they're not just trying to cram everything into the page. Sidebars flow down underneath menus. You get actual menu buttons you could press, and then people can see a large navigation menu for your site. A lot of fantastic things they're doing there with the responsive design. And another thing that they've added not too long ago, it's not brand new anymore, but it's the commerce feature. And they're expanding it out to other countries. I believe United States and Canada have it. UK has it now. That's going to be expanding in the future more, I am sure. And they partnered up with Stripe to allow you to process credit cards. You can sell physical or digital goods on your website. You can get your shipment information. It will calculate taxes for you. Really, really fantastic system. Makes it very easy for you to set up an online store, which in the past has been rather cumbersome to do. I know I've tried to do it myself, and the Squarespace system is by far the easiest thing you'll find anywhere. And you only have to pay Squarespace for the commerce package, which is $24 a month. And then you pay a little small fee to Stripe for credit card processing, as you would with any system. But you don't have to go out and get a third-party commerce system and try to integrate that into your site. It's all there for you in one package with Squarespace. So that is a fantastic system. We talked about getting your content up front. It's very easy to do. Drag and drop blocks onto the page, drop them into a grid to create your site. Then you can use sliders and other controls to tweak the design. But if you are a developer and you want 100% control over every line of code, you can go into developer mode and create a site using tools that you're familiar with from more traditional methods, while at the same time leveraging the power of Squarespace. And that's their developer mode, which is also fantastic. But you know, Matthew, the best way to find out how great all this stuff is just to go try it for yourself. And you can do that absolutely free for 14 days. There's no credit card required. Just put in your name and an email address, and in a matter of minutes, you'll be building your own website. You can use all the features of Squarespace for free for 14 days. And then when you sign up, and I know you're going to want to, as a Trek FM listener, you can save 10% off your lifetime purchase on new accounts by using our offer code TREK9. And again, as I mentioned at the beginning, choose that annual plan and get a free custom domain registration as well. So support us and support Squarespace. Go try this fantastic platform for free for 14 days at squarespace.com. And then use offer code TREK9 to save 10%. And we really thank Squarespace for their support of Trek FM and the network. And we thank you for supporting Squarespace.
Well, Chris, we had just a great news segment. A lot of things have been happening recently in the Trek literary world. And so one of the things that happened this week is we had the drop of Ongoing 25, which I have been looking forward to. We have finally finished the After Darkness series and now getting into some real meat here. I feel like we've been waiting for this comic ever since we saw Into Darkness. And then the bits and pieces that we liked in After Darkness, and now we're finally getting the resolution to some of those things we saw in the background.
Right. But don't you kind of feel like this should have been After Darkness in the first place, and we should have just not had the After Darkness that we had?
You know, I honestly think what they should have done is had After Darkness be three very intense, intrigue-filled, you know, Section 31 comics with what's going on in the background, giving us some of the sidebar of how the Enterprise crew is dealing with this thing that's happened to him, and then really jumped into this Khitomer conflict, which this is great. This is part one of four that just came out today. And I have to say, just right off the bat, the cover artwork is really nice here. Great scary Klingon on the front, excellent view of the Enterprise at warp. I think it's a pretty epic cover for what's about to happen.
Don't you think they should have given this Klingon one gold tooth in the front, though?
Well, yes.
With a diamond
then he
in
would
it.
Have been, yeah, ghetto Klingon. Yeah. But definitely, I have to say, too, that's one of the things that really works here is these Klingons that they created for the JJ universe. I think they work pretty well in the comic. Yeah. They look good. They look like Klingons, and they look scary and mean, and I like it. I like the way they look. There are a little uniform here with the artwork for the Klingons. The foreheads are all pretty much the same, but it is a comic. I'm not going to, you know, you don't want to have to draw every individual Klingon differently.
Well, I think that's the thing about the JJ Klingons, though, and I agree that they come off better here in this comic than they did on screen and Into Darkness, in what we saw on screen anyway. But the forehead ridges, I feel like in the JJ universe, in the Abramsverse here, that the Klingons all have uniform ridges on their heads. It's not like the prime timeline where the original idea was that the the patterns had to do with family lineage and such.
Yeah, I like this look. I think it works. I think that I just wish, you know, Into Darkness, we had maybe seen more of the Klingons. You know, we only got to see one of the guys with his helmet off. And so we might have seen some differentiation between what they look like.
I told you before, because I played Star Trek Rivals card game for so long before I was able to see Into Darkness, I was expecting to see a lot more Klingons in the movie because there are a bunch of different Klingons with names in that card game. And I think some of those names maybe come from the 2009 film from parts of the story that were cut with the Klingons, but I was expecting to see a lot more of these guys in the movie.
Yeah, definitely.
So, yeah.
Well, I like the way that this comic does start. You're on a planet, you're on Khitomer, actually, which, you know, we all know from the Khitomer Accords, from where they were signed, Star Trek VI, one of my favorites. Great to see the Klingons building their brand new colony on this planet.
Yeah.
And
of course, Worf's background as well, don't forget.
Exactly, yes. This is where Worf's family is from. So, which is another great, fantastic thing. These guys, though, man, they are all working hard. They are ripped to the nines.
They are.
So this is these Klingons I would not want to get in a fist fight with.
Well, you know, usually we see Klingons in their big body suit, the big armor and all. But, you know, Matthew, I mean, if you were as ripped as these guys are in the comic, wouldn't you just go shirtless all the time as well, just like they do?
You know, Chris, if I did look like this, I think that everybody would want me to go shirtless all the time. I do not, therefore I wear a shirt. But
your colleagues,
I think that's exactly what
appreciate you not coming to work shirtless, right?
Yeah, exactly. Everybody appreciates that, honestly.
So yeah, they're building the colony here, and I thought it was an interesting move as well. And I'm not fluent in Klingon, so I don't know, but the characters here do speak in Klingon, and then they have the little boxes down in the bottom corners of the frame to give you the translation. But I did like the fact that they are speaking Klingon because, again, you would expect them to speak their own language on that world, and it gives you that, you know, more of a feeling that you're there with them. I wonder if this Klingon is accurate. You know, did they go and actually have someone from the Klingon Language Institute or somewhere translate the copy for the comic?
You know, that's a good question. And I wouldn't even think about that, Chris, because I'm not fluent in Klingon either. I missed those classes in school. But I think you're right too. It did really help set the mood, you know, that these Klingons would all be speaking in Klingon, and just that little extra touch was really I thought it was really cool.
It was cool. And the Klingon sounds accurate. I mean, it really does sound like Klingon. So it does make me think that they did have someone who does know Klingon translate copy, because it doesn't sound like someone's just making stuff up here.
Well, and so these Klingons, they're building the settlement. And all of a sudden, an orbital ship just starts bombarding this colony and just laying waste to everything. The Klingons really have, you know, absolutely no hope of, you know, defending themselves against this, because, their ships in orbit have already been destroyed. And then, you know, I thought this was really interesting when I read this the first time, Chris. I noticed this immediately on this page where the Romulans are. It's page 6. You see these weapons, and immediately you realize these weapons aren't Romulan, because they look just like the weapons on the Vengeance that, you know, Scotty shuts down, and you don't see really
very
used.
Good point.
Yeah.
Yes, that's a very good point.
I immediately realized that this is harkening back to what we saw with Section 31 being involved with the Romulans. Yeah. Something's going on here. We know they're going to try and start a war between the Romulans and the Klingons. Really cool.
But the way they're used here in the comic is really cool, in that, you know, these are Romulan, they look like Romulan warbirds, a kind of a combination between a warbird and a bird of prey. Mm-hmm. But the, you know, the nose is like the warbirds in the TNG era. But what's cool about these weapons is that they're like the talons of a bird of prey,
right,
extending down, which is kind of cool. And they look cooler on here than they did on the Vengeance and Into Darkness.
Yeah, it looks really good. I like this artwork. I think it's great. And I'm definitely glad to start seeing this connection here. And, you know, it's what we've been hoping for. Then what's funny is you have this dramatic shift from this destruction. And then you get to this starbase, where Kirk and his crew are about to embark on their 5-year mission. And I liked this. I loved that, you know.
They're eventually going to go on this mission, right?
Yeah,
eventually.
It'll happen.
One of these days they're going to go.
It does kind of make me wonder if they're stalling because
they're stalling, yes.
Yeah, they're stalling because of the film. Because they're not really sure what they're going to do with the film yet. And because of that, because they're still working on that script right now, they don't really want to give away too much of,
I think, yeah,
this 5-year mission, or have them do it. So I like this. What I really just liked about this scene, though, is Chris, it gave the crew an opportunity, you know, Kirk to kind of get a scene with some people he doesn't normally get a scene with, you know, just kind of hanging out with Chekhov and Sulu. I really liked that. I thought it was well done, and it just made sense. You know, this crew does need a little bit of downtime and a little bit of bonding time, and I just liked seeing them kind of give that to him.
I like the dialogue here and the voices, and it says one last chance for the Enterprise to pick up new crew, and Sulu says, "This is dumb." Kirk says, "It's not dumb, Sulu." And then Chekhov, "It's a little bit dumb, Captain."
Yeah.
It's just perfect voice for Sulu there.
Oh, and what's fun too is that I love that that Kirk is making him cover his eyes like
cover
a 5-year-old.
Eyes, yeah.
It's awesome. And the surprise is, hey, we've got a brand new engineering officer, and it's Hikaru's sister going to be part of the team. So that's exciting. Glad to see that. That'll be, I think, fun and interesting developments for Sulu as a character then.
And I was also glad to see that they made his sister, Yuki, actually look Japanese, because Star Trek, as so much of Hollywood does, seems to have this mass confusion about Asian races and, you know, who's Japanese and who's Korean and who's Chinese, which actually they're quite distinctive, but apparently to Hollywood they're all the same. But at least here they actually did make her look Japanese, like a Japanese woman, which I personally appreciated living in Japan.
Yeah. And what's fun about this is, you know, she's signed up. She's really excited about being on this 5-year mission with the rest of the Enterprise crew. And you know, Hikaru is not too happy about this. Also, she has this nice little pet name for him that she calls him, and which is Hiki. Is that how you say that?
That's how you would say it, although no one would ever do that here.
So. Did she just call you Hiki? And he goes, no. And then Kirk goes, adorable. Like, you just can almost hear Chris Pine going, dude, that's totes. Like, just making fun of it. It's awesome.
Well, you know, if they had holodeck technology on the Enterprise here in the Abramsverse, that Kirk would go down and program that great getaway, the Hiki room. The Hiki, 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 Hiki room.
Exactly. Oh, man, it'd be full of Orion slave girls. So we get this great introduction, and what it's really cute here is that Chekhov is completely taken with his sister already, what was great about this is that instead of it just being kind of a cute scene, they deal with something that, you know, we've seen on Star Trek before, and it'll be interesting to see them play out, is this idea of family on a starship, and that, you know, they do obviously discourage having whole families on starships, but that having brothers and sisters is okay. And Sulu's really worried about, you know, how this is going to impact his performance of not, how do I not worry about my little sister the whole time and do my job? And I love how, you know, Kirk responds, you know, that, you know, if you think you're going to be that compromised, then you believe in yourself a lot less than I do. And I need you to trust me on this. And I thought that was a great moment for Kirk, you know, just showing his belief in his crew, how much he cares about them. It's a good scene.
The other thing it does besides the family angle, which is a great point, is that it continues what they have tried to do with Uhura in the ongoing comics and in Into Darkness, which is in the 23rd century setting to try to play up female characters a bit more as being strong and capable. And because what Kirk tells Sulu here is that, you know, one reason she's on the ship is she's first in her class. You know, she's one of the best engineers that we can find. She's not here because she's your sister. She's here because she's one of the best. And it continues that, which I know that was Roddenberry's vision, and he tried to do that by having Uhura on the show in the original series, but because of the nature of television and the culture of the society in the 60s, And even into the 80s, even in The Next Generation, you know, Troy and Beverly were weak characters on the show, weak female characters. Here, we're picking that up in the comic as well, trying to further that in the Abrams verse, I think, that the female characters are strong as well.
Yeah, I think that it's a great thing to be able to see that. I also think that it's hopefully going to be a nice change from Uhura herself in this series and where she's been and not having and maybe it'll give them a chance to bond as characters as well, her and you know, Sulu's sister here. And
so you think that Yuki Sulu and Uhura are going to go down and stretch together and say, does it ever make your toes curl?
Exactly. No, I think it would just be great to see, you know, Uhura get to have a relationship with somebody other than Spock on the ship. And, you know, two strong women, hopefully, together, and instead of it just always being about her and Spock. And so,
well, don't forget that we also have Carol on the ship now, which they do pick up as we go through the comic. So we have Yuki, we have Carol Marcus, and we have Uhura all now.
That's true. And, you know, we get to see Carol in here, and we get to see some worry from Kirk about her, which I think is nice. And you can see a little bit, I think, that their friendship is growing in this comic. It's very subtle, but I just like the way they're doing it, you know, to keep it that way for a while, that it's not just a quick, oh, we kind of like each other, let's jump into bed real quick, because that's what we do.
Right.
It looks like they're going to actually try and develop that.
Yeah. Let me ask you a question, because of course everyone's wondering with Carol Marcus on the ship now, whether David will eventually be born in the Abramsverse and if Kirk and Marcus are going to have this relationship or not. Did you get the feeling when you're watching Into Darkness, though, where when Carol Marcus comes up to the bridge and she wants to talk to her dad on the Vengeance, I thought it was interesting how Kirk calls her Carol at that point, because I felt like there's so much more that's already gone on in their relationship that we don't see, because I don't know, it's just calling her Carol really made me feel that way. And then now that you see in the comic and he's calling her Carol again here in the comic, and I felt that. Do you feel that way, or am I just reading?
You know, that's
too much
a good point. I honestly hadn't thought about that at all. That is an interesting point. You know, I guess I feel like it might have been a representation of Kirk really accepting her as part of the crew as much as anything else. As quickly as he does everyone. I mean, you know, he would. I feel like they're, you know, calling Scotty and instead of, you know, Mr. Scott, you know, that's his way of being, you know, Kirk always has this with his crew. And so he kind of takes these liberties, whereas, you know, other captains might not do that, but that's not Kirk for them. You know, for him, this is family. And he even says that at the end, he's like, welcome to the family. And she's like, it's nice to have one.
Well, you know that he warms up to Keenser when he starts calling him Roy.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes, exactly.
All right. So we'll see where the Carol Marcus thing goes. But we do see some concern for her here.
Well, one quick thing I want to point out is they say that they got a shiny new warp core. And if you look behind if you look behind Scotty, that warp core looks very, very much like a warp core that we've seen before. And it looks just like something you would have seen on the Enterprise E, actually.
It does.
And so maybe they'll follow the comics and actually give us a warp core that looks like a Star Trek warp core, at least the ones we've known.
Maybe. Do you want them to do that, though? I feel like creatively, first of all, I think there will only be three movies. I really don't see them doing a fourth movie, personally. They've already done two with the engineering section the way it is right now. Wouldn't you want them to just do the third one the same way instead of having some kind of massive redesign of the ship.
Yeah, I mean, they already did change it for the second film anyway. The main engineering was not the brewery. I mean, you went through the brewery for a little bit, but the actual main engineering core was, you know, that brand new set, which was fantastic. I think it worked well. I still hate the brewery. Different. I think it looks stupid, but this worked a lot better. And so I was glad that they did that. So, you know, it's fine. I just thought that was interesting. So jumping ahead, we get this fact that they intercept this Klingon distress call, they call it, which it's not really a distress call, as Uhura says. It's a call for vengeance because their colony has been destroyed on Kinemur. And Kirk says, we're going to go check this out. Spock's like, that's not a good idea. And Kirk's like, look, we have to clean up this mess that Marcus started. This could be our way to have the olive branch. Let's go do it. And then you get this quick scene of the Section 31 agent talking to the Romulans that have just destroyed the colony, and they thank them for the weapons that they really enjoyed from Section 31, which helped them to obliterate the Klingons quickly.
We enjoyed your weapons.
Exactly. They were excellent. Then they talk about how, you know, how are we going to split up these this empire once it's destroyed, and we'll talk about that later. So, you know, something else is coming on each side there. And then you jump right back to the Enterprise, and they land on the planet, even though Spock's not about that either. And they're trying to help. They're trying to find anybody who's left. And then the Klingons arrive in those fancy new birds of prey that we saw at the end of After Darkness.
Yeah. A few things interesting to me here. In terms of the artwork, is the fact that when we really see the Romulans, they look a lot more like the Romulans that we're familiar with from the Prime timeline, as opposed to Nero. I know Nero was maybe not military, and those were maybe like civilian Romulans that have all the crazy facial tattoos on them. These guys feel a lot more like actual Romulans. The interior of the ship feels more like Romulans as well. And So the thing here, the Klingons arrive. What we end up with here at the end is a war between, as I take it anyway, the Klingons and the Federation, which is what Admiral Marcus said was coming. But it's interesting to me that it's all set up as, and this comic was billed as, open warfare between the Romulans and the Klingons, but it's more like the Romulans attacking the Klingons in order to start a war between the Klingons and the Federation, as opposed to it being a Romulan-Klingon war per se. But of course, the Romulans and the humans are working together via Section 31, ultimately, to conquer the Klingons. It's kind of like a twisted web that they spun
here. It seems like a triangle, where, you know, the Romulans will be attacking the Klingons will be attacking the Federation and the Romulans, and they'll, you know, they're, yeah. I feel like it's kind of convoluted in that sense. And yet, you know, I feel like, though, in the end, it's going to be the Enterprise and her crew that help avert all the wars in general in the end.
Oh, well, of course. They're always in the middle of it.
Yeah, and so, well, they were the only ship in the sector.
That's right.
And so Kirk's the only one that's crazy enough to go to a Klingon planet and land on it. So, but I love the way this ends, you know, the fact that, you know, you're bringing up the Into Darkness bits of the fact that the Klingons know that Kirk is the one who landed on their planet, and they are the ones that, are responsible for what happened. I think that that's fantastic that you're using all of that and putting it all together. And the fact that the landing party ends up on the Klingon ship with, you know, Kirk there at the Klingon's feet, which is Kor, which is awesome.
Which is Kor, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And then it's the whole bum 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 moment, and we have to wait till next month to figure out what happens. Man, love this comic. This is really what I wanted After Darkness to be, and I am glad that we are finally here.
It is good, yeah. I enjoyed it as well. I almost wish that it was more... There was more depth to it. Like a lot of the comics that we review here on the show when we do the 4 or 5-part series, some of the comics from, I don't know, you know, 5, 6 years ago or so, which have a lot more text to them. They're a lot denser. They're more like novels. They really, really pull you into the story a little bit more. This is a story where I would love to see that kind of depth. Of course, in the end, when we take all 4 parts together, we're going to have that kind of story. But this we talked about on here before too. You know, this Kittimer conflict story would make a great movie. It's like what we feel like the third movie should be. But of course, they want to produce these comics and do all this stuff between now and 3 years from now when we get the next movie. But you almost want it to be like a Star Trek II, Star Trek III kind of thing, where the story's just continuing in the next movie, even though it's a few years before you get it. And the war that Marcus was looking for is what we get in the third movie. And that's what we're getting here. But boy, wouldn't it make a great story for a film?
Yeah, I really think it would, Chris. I'm with you. I wish that the comics to me have really legitimized the JJ verse and what it could be. And I really wish that we would see some of these kind of things in the films, because I'm really doing a great job, I think, of giving us a fantastic look at this universe, opening it up, all the possibilities, all the things kind of fans thought it would be, because we had all these open possibilities. And yeah, I really like I really like what they're doing. And two, I just have to say, as a comic goes, you know, for artwork, I really like the artwork. I think it's fantastic. I think the characters and a lot of the scenes look really good. And I was really drawn in by it. I was never taken out of it at any moment. And so, hands down for me, one of the best we've seen in a while for ongoing comics. I really enjoyed it.
I think when I was reading it, the likeness of Carol Marcus to Alice Eve was really, really well.
Yes, which nobody complains about.
Nobody, especially not page 17 here down at the bottom.
Exactly. Corner. Exactly.
So I enjoyed this. I'm looking forward to seeing where it goes. I just want to see where it goes. I want to see what the Section 31 involvement is and how deeply they follow the triangle that we're talking about here. Because, you know, in the end, the Romulans aren't actually going to share anything with the humans. So that's going to have to come to a head. And of course, they're not going to destroy the Klingons completely. Star Trek would be Klingons. So I don't know where this is headed, but I'm looking forward to finding out. It's a real shame that we're going to have to wait 3 more months to get to the final part of this. So it's going to be a slow crawl.
Exactly.
All right. Well, this has been great. Short feature today, just reviewing this one comic, but we had so much stuff to talk about in news. We thought we would keep the show to a reasonable length overall. So we hope you've enjoyed that. But you know, it's not the only thing that we've been talking about here on Trek FM this week. So here are some other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Orb.
Aliens of Deep Space Nine.
That's a really good question. I honestly never even thought to question the Vorta's idea of their own existence and whether or not it was, you know, just a story.
Earl Grey.
The 1701D.
So correct me if I'm wrong, it's been a little while since I've seen Generations, but is it possible also that before it was used as stellar cartography, it might have been Cerebro?
The Ready Room.
Homefront and Paradise Lost.
See, that's the kind of guy I want to vote for. Yeah. If he says, I don't want to do this, please don't vote for me, that job looks really hard, I'm going to go, I like this guy.
To the journey!
Collective commentary.
Right, no. The Borg does not.
They don't procreate like that. They have to assimilate.
Because that I just thought was strange. Like, okay, so one of the people they assimilated was pregnant, or okay.
Commentary, Trek stars.
Roswell.
And that was what Kadams was going for in season one. He saw it as more of a metaphor than anything. He didn't really care about the actual science fiction behind it. And he said that he got a note from a network exec which just said, aliens, aliens, aliens.
Warp 5.
The Sphere Builders.
And it is a good concept. I think it, and obviously the reasons it was introduced were more because of the studio and wanting that looking forward perspective, you know, getting ahead of the 24th century.
Trek News and Views.
Who watches the watchers?
Which also brings into question Dr. Crusher, because, you know, Pulaski can put a new heart in him, but Beverly Crusher can't even heal an arrow wound.
Literary Treks.
Assignment Earth Comics.
I kind of liked it in that it picks up from Assignment Earth, the Star Trek episode, where we find out that Gary Seven has been sent there to find out why the two agents who were supposed to be stopping that missile launch can't do it. What happened to them?
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and get your daily Trek Talk fix. We have new Trek Talk for you every day of the week, and some days we even have two shows for you, and you'll find them all in iTunes, on Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, Xbox, Zune. You can download or stream from the website. Many, many ways for you to get the shows. And you can find links to everything on our website by going to trek.fm/pd for podcast directory. Now, Matthew, let's tell everyone where to contact us if they'd like to share their thoughts on ongoing number 25 or on, you know, any of the great recommendations that Dayton had for us in novels today. You can go to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose to send to a show and choose Literary Treks, and that will come to Matthew and me by email. You can also send us a voicemail if you'd like. There's a tab on the right-hand side of every page on the website. If you click it, you can use your webcam to record a message for us and upload it to us as an MP3 file. And then in social media, you'll find us on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM and on Twitter, where we're always tweeting away about Star Trek under username TrekFM. Now, Matthew, you know, when you're not talking to Chekhov about Sulu's sister who has joined the crew, well, where can people find you?
Well, Chris, if you'd like to find me, you can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02. And you can also find me doing The Orb with you, where we talk about Deep Space Nine, and we do that all the time on that show. So those are the two places that are probably best to find me, as well as doing the book reviews, which I'll have a new one coming out soon of David R. George III's newest book in the beginning of the fall series, so working my way through that. Now, Chris, you know, when you're not hanging out with Kirk making Sulu cover his eyes, where can we find you?
I love doing that. Well, you can find me with Kirk working on the Hiki Room program and also with Yuki getting tips on what that should entail. But now you can find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's the letter C and Brian with a Y. You can find me pretty much everywhere in social media under that same username and on my personal website at cbrianjones.com. And then Matthew, besides the shows that we do together, you can find me on Tuesdays on The Ready Room, where you're with me sometimes, as are other hosts from all across the network, as well as special guests. And we talk about all five live action Star Trek series, as well as Star Trek news on that show. And then on Fridays, you'll find me with Kate Walsh on Warp 5, where we talk about Enterprise and interview various people involved with the creation of Star Trek as well. So check that show out also. And Matthew, also, before we let everyone go, we'd like to ask you to please support our sponsor for this week's show. And that sponsor is, of course, Squarespace, the web's best hosting and CMS that makes it simple for you to create a beautiful blog, website, portfolio, an online store, or really anything you could imagine. Create your own space today. You're absolutely going to love it. I certainly do. Go to squarespace.com and get your free 14-day trial. There's no credit card required. Just put in your name and your email address, and in a matter of minutes, you'll be building your own website. And then when you decide to sign up, use offer code TREK9 to save 10% off your lifetime purchase on new accounts. And choose the annual plan, and you could even get a free custom domain registration as well. So go try it out. Support us. Support Squarespace. They help us bring Literary Treks to you every week, and we really appreciate their support. And also, if you'd like to support what we're doing here, you can go to trek.fm/donate, where we have 8 alien badges. They're custom illustrations by Toba Ushi, who does most of the artwork that you see on your website. They're available at both as badges and as art prints, and you can choose what you want. You can mix and match. We have different contribution levels that you can make. And your donations help us pay for the costs of production, storage, and bandwidth that's needed to bring our programming to you every week. So go on over to trek.fm/donate, get your aliens today, and we really thank you for your support of Trek FM and Literary Treks.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. And until next time, live long and read on.
You call that light reading?
To each his own, number one.
Chekhov checking out Sulu's sister's pants.
She didn't have no pants on. She had the miniskirt. Why do you think Chekhov was in love?
Better keep an eye on Chekhov.
I love that. And he's just like, that's not even funny.